Hey, good afternoon, everyone. It's Cole Johnson here with Mojo with Kojo. This is my good friend and coworker, Miranda Halls. It
Nailed it.
is Sunday, January 9th, 2025, about 1:01 p.m. So I have Miranda on today for the podcast. So I'm going to go ahead and we're going to go ahead and jump into her bio, and then we'll go ahead and jump into the questions. Miranda, if you have any questions or if you want to add anything or if I jack anything up, feel free to punch me in the nuts later.
Will do.
All right. So Miranda is a graduate of Norwich University cum laude with a BA in criminal justice. She commissioned as a second lieutenant in the U.S. Army as a transportation officer in 2007. Lieutenant Halls was stationed at Fort Drum, New York from 2008 to 2012, deployed to Iraq in 2008-2009, then to Afghanistan in 2010-2011. Captain Halls completed the captain career course in 2012 at Fort Lee, Virginia, and then was stationed at Fort Stewart, Georgia, then deployed to Afghanistan in 2013 for a third deployment. Captain Halls left active duty in 2014, and in 2017 she was promoted to the rank of major. Congratulations, that's a big deal. She was honorably discharged from inactive Ready Reserve Unit in 2020. Miranda's awards and decorations include two Bronze Stars, Army Commendation Medal, 3, Army Achievement Medal, 2, Meritorious Unit Award, National Defense Service Medal, Global War on Terrorism Expeditionary Medal, Global War on Terrorism Service Medal, Afghanistan Campaign Medal with 3 campaign stars, Iraq Campaign Medal with 2 campaign star 2 campaign stars, a Defense Service Medal, Combat Action Badge. Miranda now works part-time for Western New York Heroes as an outreach/casework assistant. Her service dog Shadow has been instrumental in allowing her to live a life of purpose and helping her fellow veterans. Thank you very much for
Perfect.
being here, Miranda. I guess I wasn't I mean, you and I have known each other for almost a year now, and forgive me, but that is a extensive military career for sure, for sure. You are my first female veteran on the podcast. I reserved this spot specifically for you. So yeah, anything else you want to add?
Hopefully I can live up to that hype, but no, it's great to be here and thanks for having me.
Oh, you more than live up to it, sister. Don't worry about that shit. All right, so I sent you the questions, right?
Sir.
All right, let me just bring them up on my phone. Yeah, I can't thank you enough for being here and expressing your interest in wanting to do this. I mean, obviously, I've said this before and I'll continue to say it until I'm blue in the face, but I couldn't do this without you guys. So thank you.
No, when you told me about what you're doing and how it started, I was like, count me in. And we made a calendar mistake, but we corrected that, so I'm happy. You know what I mean? It worked out good.
Yeah, so am I. All right. So how was your childhood, or what was your childhood like?
Yeah, so I grew up in a pretty small town in Dover, New Hampshire. It's pretty close to the ocean and near Maine. Small community. It was a good place to grow up. You could ride your bike around the town and do all sorts of stuff. And that was really good. So my parents bought my grandparents, my mom's parents' house. And then my grandparents moved into an apartment complex, maybe a quarter mile away from the old house. So I would go over and see my grandparents every day. They watched me as a kid. So it would, in that sense, it was really good. And other things, my childhood were not so good, but we'll just leave those there.
Yeah, you can talk about it. You can talk about as much or as little as you want. Again, this is your story. This is not mine, so I don't want you to feel like, you have to share stuff, especially if it was traumatic or, something like that.
Yeah, so that was pretty much my childhood. I had a good, nothing major, nothing.
And you have siblings, correct?
Yeah, I have one older sister. And so yeah, we're pretty close and we're complete opposites, but
And you are a doting aunt. You love your nieces and nephews and stuff. So I think that's one of the not one not not the only thing that attracts me to you, but like that is a big thing. That's a big proponent of my life too, or my kids and
Yeah,
my family.
family.
So yeah,
Correct.
family is a big deal. So are you a Pats fan then, or
I am. I was born and raised in New Hampshire, and then, like you said before, I went to Norwich University, which was founded in Norwich, Connecticut. But the cadets burned down one of the barracks in the late 1800s. The school was founded in 1819, so they bought a bunch of land up in Vermont to, insulate us crazies. So the first time they won a Super Bowl, I was up at Norwich, and it was crazy. Everyone went wild. But I
So
remember
what?
when Tom Brady took over for Drew Bledsoe, and everyone was like, "He's a bum. He went to Michigan. He's no good. Look, he's scrawny." And look,
Yeah.
ends up being one of the greatest of all time.
Yeah. Yeah, every time I think about that, I mean, that just goes to show you, dude, right place at the right time, you know? So can you talk a little bit about what it was like? 'Cause I don't know anything about what it's like going to like a military university or like a, 'cause what was high school and like elementary and high school and middle school and stuff like? Was that all military related too or no?
No. So if you want to ask me the second question, then I'll tie it all back in.
Okay. So why did you join the military?
All right. So, when I entered high school, I had read a book called A Walk in the Woods. It's about hiking the Appalachian Trail. So I got it in my idea that in my mind that I was going to graduate high school early, which I did, to go hike the Appalachian Trail. My junior year, 2001, obviously, September 11th happened. I was actually in a class called Current Events where we watched the news. So I watched it as a kid. And
What
everyone,
grade were you in?
I was in 11th grade.
So was I. And I was in American history class when it happened.
And so my grandfather was drafted in World War II and he was an infantryman in the Philippines. And I never understood him until after I became a combat veteran and lived experiences that are, traumatic. Some would say life-changing, alternating, they change the trajectory of your life for sure. And after September 11th, I remember talking with my grandfather and he said, kid, this is your Pearl Harbor. This is your generation's Pearl Harbor. My parents really wanted me to go to college. I want to enlist. I almost enlisted in the Navy. But I was talking to my high school guidance counselor because I was graduating early. And she told me about Norwich University and how they had a prior student from 2 years ago, graduate from this high school and went there. So I looked into it and they had all four branches of ROTC. I really wasn't sure which one I was going to pick. And you can live two different lifestyles at Norwich. You can live the military lifestyle where you wear a uniform, you make your rack. This is back in BDU days. So we're, polishing boots and shining our low quarters. But we live that military lifestyle. And then you obviously go into whatever ROTC branch you want and then commission from there. So Norwich is the oldest private military college in the United States. Like I said before, it was founded in 1819. And then it's the birthplace of ROTC. So the founder of Norwich wanted to build a citizen soldiery of professionals. So that's your doctors, your lawyers, your teachers. So that's where the Reserve Officer Training Corps came from. What ROTC is now is universities and colleges across the nation have different programs where they have active duty NCOs and officers lead these cadets in, training to a culmination event. So my junior year of college, we went out to Fort, oh goodness, let no. No. Was in Washington. It's gonna come to me later. I can't believe I forgot it.
Is it Fort
Lewis, Fort
Lee?
Lewis. No,
Lewis.
Fort Lewis. Yeah, Fort Lewis, Washington. So you fly out there, and it's like a 30-day assessment of, PT, marksmanship, land navigation, all this stuff. And since I went to Norwich and lived that military lifestyle, this was second nature to me. I had a blast at advanced camp. I had a blast. And so then after that, your senior year, you put in your wish list for what branch you want. I think you have to select up to 16 branches, in order. Then I picked Transportation Corps first. I didn't want to fly. And transportation, you know, nothing happens till something moves, and it's the biggest branch as you go up. A lot of the other branches, like infantry, need a lot of lieutenants and captains, but they don't need so many field grades and general officers and so forth. So that's why I picked that through Norwich. And, you know, my grandfather pinned me at my commissioning.
Wow, that's very cool.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome. And when I got back from Iraq, I remember, you know, he's almost 80 at this point, and he goes, "You're a veteran of a foreign war." And he was so proud of that. And he gave me his actual silver CIB.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So my grandfather was, you know, nothing shook him. Nothing made him mad. He didn't drink. He didn't smoke. He didn't gamble. Everything was just cool as a cucumber. I remember I was probably 8 or 9, and he got a new car, and I hop in the car and I shut the door. Well, I shut the door on his finger. He reaches in, undoes it, shakes it, and goes, "Oof, you got me." And I remember that because I knew I had done that not as hard to my own finger. And I cried for like 30 minutes, if not longer. Yeah. And this guy, just shakes it off. Yeah. But, you know, he was hand-to-hand combat in the Philippines. I mean, I've shared some stories with you, and just once he had an enemy soldier jump out in front of him and fire at him with a handgun. But since it was so wet there, the ammunition was garbage. It didn't go off. My grandfather pulled out his .45 and shot the guy in the head. He was 18 years old when he was in the Philippines. You know, he was from way up northern Maine, grew up on a farm, you know. Yeah. So he's some hick farmer that doesn't know the way of the world, and he learned really quickly.
Yeah, that's crazy, man. So what else? So you graduated high school, and then you went into you were already in the military, right?
No, yeah, I graduated high school. I did 1,200 miles of the 2,100 mile Appalachian Trail by myself.
Wow.
And then I started at Norwich. Excuse me. My junior year, I got an ROTC scholarship. So at that point, you're contracted. So I have an obligation of 4 years active and 4 years inactive reserve once I commission. So that's when I was, you know, I didn't have, you got paid like $500 a month, which, you know, bought beer and gas.
Right.
But, you know, like nothing big. And then.
Did you commission, or when did you actually go to the Army?
Yeah. So I commissioned the day after my graduation. So you have to, because you have to hold a degree. And so you have graduation, then you have commissioning. So that was in May of 2007. I started active duty June 1st, 2007.
Now, because I don't know how this works. So you didn't have to go to Army boot camp, right? Or did you have to go to OCS or anything like that?
No, since I did ROTC that junior year of college at the advanced camp, that was like your culminating event. If you failed out of that, you're not commissioning. But once you commissioned, we did a basic officer leader course, BOLIC. 1 and 2 or 2 and 3. So ROTC was considered basic officer leader course 1. 2 was held at Fort Benning, Georgia. And that was more of land nav, shooting, just getting us ready. Because when we commissioned, we were, you know, in a time of war. It was all volunteer army. No one made me do anything. This is 100% my choice. But they were finding a lot of officers were not competent when they got overseas. So they started Bullock 2 at Fort Benning. After we did that, I went to Fort Eustis for my Bullock 3, which would be your branch-specific course. Mine was transportation. So there we learn about rail. We learn about all the different boats that the Army has, all the different vehicles, you know, convoy planning, load planning for fixed wing and rotary, you know, how you do a sling load. I think we talked about those the other day. So we learned that it's actually one of the longer Bullock 3 courses. And then after that, I got stationed. Well, when I was in Bullock, I was supposed to go to Fort Lewis. I was going to go to Fort Lewis for my duty station, and I did not want that. So another gentleman in the class before me was going to Drum. And so we talked to our branch manager, and we got it switched. So I got to go to Drum.
So you went to Fort Drum?
Yeah, I wanted to go there. I wasn't sure how long I was going to stay in. My parents still lived in New Hampshire. My sister was in Connecticut at the time, so I wanted to stay on the East Coast and up north. And
So for the listening audience, for those folks that don't know where Fort Drum is, where is Fort Drum?
Fort Drum is in Watertown, New York. It's about 4 hours northeast from Buffalo, if you're looking on a map.
Gotcha, gotcha. So what was it like? I mean, I can't imagine. I mean, like you were born and bred like for the military, essentially. And that was all your choice. What
Yes.
was it? What was it like? So you got stationed at Fort Drum. What was it like? Like, I don't want to say entering the fleet. That's what it's called whenever you hit the Marine Corps. You hit the fleet. That's when you go to your first duty station. I don't know what it's called for the Army. But so what was that like going to your actual first duty station?
I was really nervous. I had no idea what to expect.
And
You
how
know,
old were you, if you don't mind me asking?
it was 23,
Okay.
the time I got to Fort Drum. It was around January of 2008.
Okay.
And when I got there, we call it in processing base. As an officer, I would get BH so I could have a housing off post, but I had to wait to get that. So I lived in temporary barracks, which is just a really crappy hotel on base, for like $10 a night.
I got you.
But it was pretty funny. So you in process the installation, the division first, and that's on main post, and then you go to your brigade, and then your battalion. And so when I went into my battalion, that's where I'm going to find out what company I'm in, what my job is, where they have me slotted. So I get there, and there's staff duty, an NCO and a soldier sitting at the desk. It's January, and the Army's uniform was the black fleece. It had no rank, no name on the front of it. So I'm leaning up against the desk, talking to this NCO and soldier, and the sergeant major comes around the corner, and his eyes just got big. They popped, and he goes, "Get the fuck off my staff duty desk." And I looked at him, I looked at them, I took a step back. I had my beret in my hand, put my beret up on there so he could see my rank. He came around the corner. He goes, "Oh shit, man, come with me." This guy scoops me up, walks me into my battalion commander's office. "Hey, this is your new lieutenant, blah, blah, blah." Battalion commander stands up, puts a coin in his hand. "I'm sure you're going to do great things." I was like, "All right, let's go." But so I got a platoon, which every second lieutenant wants. They want to become a platoon leader. So you have soldiers. So I got a transportation platoon in Alpha Company. We did distro, so we would move whatever needed for the brigade around.
And how many soldiers were in your platoon?
About 80 soldiers to include NCOs. I was the only officer. But my first platoon sergeant, Staff Sergeant Harris, him and I, he had never experienced a leader like me, and I had never experienced an NCO like him before. And he would always be like, "This is, ma'am, this is NCO business. You don't need to do it." And I said, "No, this is platoon business." And our first counseling that we did together, him, and it's me setting the tone of like what I expect. And my number one thing, all caps, because I gave it to him too, "Look out for you, me. Have my back. If I'm fucking up, let me know." And I thought that was the right way of, doing it. And after I talked to him, he goes, "You are the first officer that has ever said that to recognize that I have value and that I've been in the Army for 23 years and I know what I'm doing." I said, "Exactly. This is not going to work if it's not together."
Yeah.
Those are the kind of relationships I try to establish with my, senior NCOs and my soldiers. Some of them were there because it was,
Forced to.
Get a felony charge or
Yeah.
join the Army and transportation. Hey, we'll give you $50,000. So, but no, I had, and that's one thing I absolutely loved about the military in Norwich is a bunch of people that come from totally different backgrounds, totally different childhoods, experiences, cultures, ethnics, religions, all that. But we all come together and, for the same reason. So I would tell my soldiers, especially since I was deployed so many times, who cares that I got a degree? Who cares what any of you did? It we're all here right now together.
Right.
It doesn't matter what we did in the past. It doesn't.
Right.
You know, we got to work as a team together.
Right.
Yeah. That's really cool. So what was it like? So then when was your first deployment? And that was to Iraq or Afghanistan?
It was to Iraq. So we left October of 2008. So I commissioned May 2007. I got there about 9 months before we deployed to my unit. So in 17 months from, you know, I raised my hand, I was in Iraq.
Right.
And that was to be expected. You know, right. I knew that was going on. I was really nervous about it and just, you know, you don't know what to expect. Sorry.
It's all good. It's all good.
So, but I did a year-long deployment there. It was the company UMO going out, which is the unit movement officer. And then when I was on R&R, my other lieutenant friends were like, Lieutenant Hulse would be a great battalion UMO. She should do it for the whole battalion.
Yeah.
Because I had just done the company. So that entailed I left Iraq about 30 days prior. All the stuff that was convoyed down, we had to wash it, just get it ready for shipment, load it on the boats. We also had helicopters. So we had to, you know, customs clear them, you know, dirt, debris, all that stuff. So it took a while. So my whole brigade was home and there was 12 of us. And so they, you know, at Fort Drum, they opened the hangar doors and the whole formation walks in. So it was one row. My 5-1 butt is on all the way to the right. You know, majors all the 7-foot guy. So there's only 12 of us. And I don't know, I thought that it would be more. I was kind of disappointed in the the welcome home ceremony. I didn't tell my family because we don't know if we're going to fly or not. We don't know when we're going to fly, how we're going to get back, all that stuff. We ended up flying, we were at Drum, we ended up flying to D.C. From our military flight and then having to fly in a civilian plane back. So.
From DC?
Yeah. Yeah.
Very nice. And so you were 23 when you deployed to Iraq?
I think I turned 24 over there. My birthday's in October, so
I got you.
We did October to October, so I think I missed one or two birthdays then.
Gotcha. So then you came back and what was it like, you know, coming back from Iraq for you, if you don't mind sharing?
It was, you know, right off the bat, as soon as I got back, I kept on always looking for my weapon. Like, where's my M4?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like that, you know, in your brain. And, you know, Iraq, we ran out of water, especially for showering. That's like the lowest level. You know, you got to do that once a week, according to the Army.
Right.
So I would find myself taking like 3 or 4 showers a day. Not very long, but I just.
When you got back home.
When I got back home, because I was like, I don't know when the next time I'm going to be able to take a shower. I want to get clean right now.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, you know, different things. So I had the opportunity to leave my unit at that point. When we were in Iraq, we had actually gotten orders to go to Afghanistan the following year. So we came home. I knew I was going to stay. Did a bunch of just activities that I wanted to do before I deployed, like went whitewater rafting, horseback riding in the Adirondacks, you know, just a bunch of fun things, you know, in that year with some of my lieutenant friends. And then that next October in 2011, we went to Afghanistan, Eastern Afghanistan.
Wow. So you did back-to-back deployments, essentially.
Yeah. So in 36 months, I did 24 months of it was deployed.
That's
12
crazy.
To Iraq, 12 to Afghanistan. Yeah.
Yeah. That's crazy.
So, yeah. And then, you know, like you said, I went to the captain's career course. And then I went to my next duty station in Fort Stewart, Georgia, 3rd Infantry Division. We were 4th Brigade. So we were the only light infantry. I know you probably don't know this, but 3rd ID is mechanized. So they have tanks.
Yep.
So out of the 4 brigades, we were the only ones non-mechanized. So we got orders to go to Eastern Afghanistan. that's really, you know, a lot changed in my life. It was a really tough deployment. I mean, we were at Fobshank most of the time, and it was Rocket City. We would get attacked daily. I mean, we would have KIAs, you know, so I got to the point where I'd rather go out on a mission if I'm going to die. I don't want to die just sitting on this base, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I did a lot of missions and did stuff like that. We were also a casualty collection point for, you know, that area. So it was just a lot of things. I realized within the first 4 months of that deployment that I was done. I just didn't have it in me. So I think your next question is like, why did you leave, right?
Yeah, but so that was your second deployment to Afghanistan, and then you had another deployment in there, right?
Yeah. So I came home from that second deployment, went to the career course. That was almost a year.
Is that for?
It's for captains. It's so, okay. Especially in so instead of I became a logistics officer.
Okay.
With a specialty of transportation. So that's okay. Where I'd use all classes of supply. So quartermaster does ammo, food, fuel, stuff like that. So I learned the quartermaster job.
Okay.
And that's armor. Cool. Yeah. So you know what I mean? You just become more well-rounded in logistics. Like the biggest, we had like a big culminating, you know, test you could say, but you had to plan all the classes of supplies. So that's, you know, class 1 through 9, water, fuel, ammo, all that stuff for a brigade, set up shower schedule, just everything logistically that you would need to do.
I could not imagine.
Yeah. And so then you have to brief one of the, you know, instructors at the class. And you know, they ask you questions and, I remember I got a 93 on it, and I was bullshit because I got everything. I was on it. Like, my fuel was like 50 gallons off. And he was like, that's insane that you got that close. And I was like, why'd you deduct so much? He's like, you went 2 minutes over. So sometimes, yeah. You know, the officer just isms. Just,
you know how it is, man. You're never going to get 100. I mean, yeah. Come on now.
But yeah, so that was fun. And then, I got stationed at Fort Stewart, you know, like I was saying, and we just did that last deployment, and
And your third deployment was to Afghanistan as well?
Yep.
So what was that rough too? Because your second one was pretty rough for you as well. So how was your third one?
Oh, my second one was, yeah, it was okay. It wasn't as bad as my third one. So they progressively got worse.
And, I gotcha.
Yeah.
So why'd you get out?
I just was mentally and emotionally exhausted. I was morally depleted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, going around just killing people in Afghanistan and not seeing any results. I mean, the civilians we worked with loved us because the Taliban would execute them and their families, abuse their wives and daughters. So working for them was good. And, you know, we were doing, you know, micro good, but in the macro version of the country, it was just
right. It was almost kind of like fighting an anthill.
Yeah. You know, and each time, you know, the rules of engagement deterred, and it made it harder and harder, because they knew these rules of engagement. So they would purposely do things like shoot at us from mosques, use children, you know, in the vehicles. Just crazy stuff like
the type of stuff you see in the movies.
Yeah. So we had a patrol out off of Airborne, and this donkey had a bunch of saddle straps on it. So this patrol went up, young second lieutenant and four other soldiers. There was explosives, and an insurgent nearby detonated and killed all five of them instantly. And so that was really hurt, because after that, the whole brigade, everything was just, you know,
yeah,
they were trying to kill us. And it was just, so I decided, you know, when I first told my first boss, she was like, what are you going to do? And I said, I'll go back to school. You know, I can go back to school, be fine. But it wasn't, you know, I didn't finish what I went to start going to school again for, but it did. Moving to Buffalo was a good thing for me. Finding my community here, finding my family and supports and stuff like that, were really beneficial and changed, you know, the trajectory of my life. I didn't think I was going to stay here at first, especially in Buffalo, but now I'm here.
I'm glad you're here.
Thanks.
So what was the transition like? You know, being a seasoned combat veteran, what was the transition like from military life to civilian life for you?
It was really hard. And one thing I noticed immediately is when I wore a uniform, my rank was on there. I had a certain respect given to me just because of that. In the civilian world, most people wouldn't have even thought that I was in the military, nonetheless an officer. And everybody knows what it feels like to be treated less than, you know, human, less than anyone else is treated when you're treated improperly or unfairly by another individual. And I felt that a lot more. I felt, especially, you know, going to the VA, I'd walk in, oh, what floor is your grandfather on? I'm going to the eye clinic, man. I'm going to the dentist. Like,
right.
Get away from me. Right. So that was hard.
Yeah, the assumptions. So what, I think I asked my brother this, but what were some of the characteristics or what were some of the traits that the military or the army kind of instilled on you, like positive, like traits and stuff like that?
Yeah. So I would definitely say integrity. That's something that started back in Norwich. So, less than 500 colleges across the United States have an honor code. Our honor code was, I will not lie, cheat, or steal, nor tolerate those who do. And that really laid the foundation for me as a young adult, you know, until now in life, you know, just do the right thing. It doesn't matter if anyone sees that you doing it or not. It's for you. You're doing it for you, not anybody else. So that was, I guess, that being punctual. My family, we were always late to everything. Now I try not to be late. It gives me anxiety, like I think most veterans have when they're running late. But yeah, just it was funny. My first semester at Norwich, you know, you have to eat your meals and blah blah blah. It's like getting treated less than a private. And so I came back, you know, on that first break, I take a shower, I'm in and out in like 10 minutes. At Norwich, you got like 7, and I have to go up a floor and down. My mom goes, who are you? Like, you just take like 40-minute shower. You would be in the bathroom for like an hour and a half. I was like, oh, yeah. So I guess, you know, just, I wouldn't say time management, but also prioritizing your time. Like, you don't need to spend an hour taking a shower. You need to take a shower and then go do other things throughout your day. Right. Right. It's important, but, you know, you just have to stay focused and not, you know, daydream and get sidetracked and stuff like that.
Right.
So I think that was, you know, a good skill that I learned.
Right.
Kind of to harken back to what you were talking about as far as, you know, when you got out of the military and you were, you know, out in public or, you know, going about your business and people were kind of, you know, treating you a certain way, not knowing or whatever. So again, I'm not originally from Buffalo. I'm originally from, you know, Florida, Gainesville, Florida. So I am from the South. I, you know, saying yes, ma'am, and please, and thank you, and no, sir, and, you know, all that was ingrained in me from childhood. And one of my first, I don't want to say negative interactions when I moved to Buffalo, but I mean, in the grand scheme of things, it was negative. I was out with the kids and at the time I was still married. And so I may have been out with the whole family, but anyway, we went to the mall and I went to open the door because that's what you do. You open the door for, you know, women, pregnant women or, you know, whatever. So I go to open the door for this lady who I assumed was pregnant because, you know, whatever. You know, she was, you know, she had a baby bump and all that stuff.
She looked the part.
Yeah, and she looked at me and was just like staring daggers at me, you know? And I was like, oh, yeah, you're welcome. And she just kind of looked at me, you know, and I told my kids, my daughter, I don't think she was old enough to even understand what was going on, but I told my son because he was old enough to understand what was up. And I looked up and looked at him and I said, listen, don't ever change who you are for someone else. Like, you know, being respectful and having respect and being polite or being humble or, you know, whatever. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. And I kind of, that's like that's one of my biggest things is respect. I'll respect you as long as you respect me. Almost to a fault, too. Someone the other day told me, and I don't know if this is true, and I'm not trying to make myself out to be something that I'm not, because that's not the point of this. But someone the other day was like, you are one of the most respectful people I've ever met in my life. And this is coming from an older person that's been around, that's been on the block for a lot longer than I have. So for someone to say, and I've never had someone tell me that before, so to be sitting with someone that I respect and for them to tell me that I'm one of the most respectful people that and polite people that they've ever met, like that really, like there is nothing wrong with, you know, being respectful. Like I think that's part of the reason why the world is so, you know, fucked up is because people don't know what it's like to be nice anymore. You know, people don't know what it's like to be kind. People don't know what it's like to open doors or say please or say thank you. And, you know, and like I told my son, I said, you know, there's nothing wrong with having respect and manners. Like, don't ever let anyone make you feel that you're in the wrong for doing that, because you're not in the wrong. They're in the wrong, you know? So I definitely feel, I understand where you're coming from with that whole kind of, you know, yeah, if I feel disrespected, man, whew, it's game over.
Well, similar to what you're saying, I will always say yes, ma'am, no, sir, yada yada. And people, I look younger than what I am, and they'll be like, "Don't call me that. I'm not old." I say, "I call my nephews and nieces ma'am and sir." I said, "It has nothing to do with your age. It's the level of respect." And
Right.
like you're saying, like you, if you want to teach kids how to be respectful, you are respectful to others and them. Like when I ask,
Right.
"Hey, can you go do this for me?" Or they ask me, "Hey, Nene, can you do this?" "Yes, sir, I sure can."
Right. Right.
Because that's the model that you emulate. But I
Right.
always find it funny when people equate being respectful because of their age. I'm not respectful because of how old or how young you are.
Right.
Yeah, I'm respectful because that's the right thing to do.
Or you get those old timers, or no, I shouldn't say old timers. I'm sorry, poor choice of words. But you get those folks that are like, you know, you say yes, ma'am, or you say no, sir, and they're like, I work for a living. And I'm like, what the fuck does that have to do with anything? I work for a living too. Like, what?
I don't know. I feel like some officers give us a bad rap, like the way that they handle themselves and talk to their subordinates. And so I think that's just a chip on the shoulder that they carry. And like you said, that's on them. Like we're not Lance Corporal and Major anymore, We're Cole and Miranda. And so I'm
Right.
gonna treat you on that human level with respect. And it
Right.
doesn't matter that you are a Lance Corporal,
Right. Yeah, I and you know, this is no disrespect to any of the people that I served with in the Marine Corps, but I served with some jack wagons as far as officers are concerned. But
Oh,
anyway,
I know a few.
that's neither here nor there. But yeah, like I mean, I guess I kind of understand, and I just want to say this. I would have loved to serve with you, and you know, to been a corporal, or whatever, because it's different for the army. But you know, whatever the equivalent of a corporal in the army was, or an NCO in the army would be, I would have loved to have served with you, because I feel like we would have been, you know, good to go. You know, because we're good to go now. You know, but yeah, yeah, the whole officer thing, like I get it, you know, that it's a necessary evil, I would say. But some of the officers that I served with in the Marine Corps were like it that and it's like you said, it's that basic human capacity, like treating people like they're human being, like human beings, not like they're dirt under your boot. And that's kind of how we were treated. I'm sorry, I don't want to say we, how I was treated in the Marine Corps. But yeah, I mean, I think that just comes with the territory. You know what I mean? Like,
One thing they taught us in ROTC is, the mission is first, but people are always. So you can't just be stepping on people to get the mission accomplished and treating them like dog shit and telling them they're dog shit.
Yeah, what's the saying? I'll never ask anyone to do anything that I wouldn't, that I'm not willing to do myself. Like I take that to heart, you know what I mean?
Exactly. I
When I
remember my first platoon, and we had motor staples. You go out and check your trucks, and I told my NCOs, clean them out. There's trash in the back. We went to the field, blah blah blah. Oh, ma'am, it's all done. It's like 1300. So I go back out there. My NCOs, where are you going, ma'am? Where are you going? Where are you going? Don't worry about it. I go to the back of the truck. I start throwing trash out. Ma'am, get out of there. We'll do it. No, you had your chance. And that was something that I. Carry on to this day is trust that they're going to do it, but verify that I got done. And instead of screaming, I just took it out. We don't get paid by the hour. We're going to be here until it's done, and so, and like you're saying, like, don't ask people to do things that you're not going to do yourself. Don't be like, hey, we got to go shoveling. Don't be out there shoveling. We got to go dig a ditch in Afghanistan to bury cable. I had blisters all over my hands.
Oh, I got some stories about Afghanistan when we deployed. I'll save that for another time, though. But yeah, when I I don't know. I think the Marine Corps, like when you join the Marine Corps, obviously you're I mean the plan for me when I joined the Marine Corps was to at least pick up NCO, so corporal, E4. And I did pick up corporal about a year before I got out. I picked up corporal in 2010. And I got out in 2011. So I was a corporal for about a year, maybe a year and some in a couple of months. But I don't know, man. Like I loved, like I really enjoyed being an NCO. And I don't say that like I wasn't like a, a dick to any of my Marines, that I was in charge of or whatever. And I was an ammo tech in the Marine Corps, so like we were like when I got put in charge of a section at the ASP, which is the ammunition supply point on Lejeune. And I think I was in section 2 or section 3. So any of you ammo techs that are watching this or listening to this, I'm pretty sure I was in section 2 or section 3. But anyway, whatever section I was in, it was all the small rounds. So like I was in charge of like millions upon billions of dollars worth of ammunition and all this stuff. And I had Marines that were in my section that I was in charge of, Lance Corporals, PFCs, privates, all that stuff. But yeah, like I don't know, man. Like I always took respect as it's not something that you're given. It's something that you're earn, you earn, and obviously like I'm not perfect. Like I had made some mistakes, and fresh when I had just picked up corporal and, kind of yelled at some Lance corporals and stuff like that. And then like, I kind of had to take a step back and kind of realize that that's not who I am. That's not the kind of leader that I want to be or anything like that. So I kind of had to like readjust and kind of find my way how to lead others and all that stuff. But yeah, I don't know where I was going with all that, so I apologize for going off subject.
No worries. Yeah, I mean, I would say at the company and platoon level, that was like the best job, being when you're a lieutenant and you don't even know that you're having the best job. Like you said, you're signed for, millions of dollars equipment. You got people under you, all this stuff, and it is fun. And you just get that unit cohesion, like you're a real team. Like, we're in it together, guys. Let's go.
So what was it like getting out? Like, what did like did you? So I know, when you talked about it in the beginning or towards the beginning, you talked, the transition was difficult and whatever, but so do you want to elaborate a little bit more about that? Or like, what was it like? Were you set up when you got out of the army? Like, did you have a resume? Did you have, were you, did you already have a service connection, stuff like that? Or was that all stuff that came, later?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So when I left, I had done 7 years active duty. So I had fulfilled my active duty commitment. And since I had those other 3 years, I actually qualified for the GI Bill. And that's why I moved up here, because I got into a yellow ribbon school. For those who don't know, it bridges the gap between the tuition costs and what the GI Bill will cover. So then you don't have to pay for any school.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so when I was getting out, I applied to a bunch of different schools. I got into the one up here, found an apartment, moved out.
Where did you go to school here? UB?
Dutiful.
Duville. Okay.
Yeah. And so when I moved up here, I knew no one, not a soul. It was very isolating.
See, I didn't know
I
anybody here either.
think I had a 10% service connection for migraines. But it, I started going to the VA, and my primary care doctor was the one was like, "I think you may need to go like talk to someone." I was like, "You're crazy, bitch! Like I'm fine."
The
Yeah, I was, and then people started talking like, "Well, maybe a PTSD." I'm like, "Fuck! I don't have PTSD. You all are the fucking problem."
I do. Yeah.
And so in 2016, I actually went to the PTSD program down in Batavia, New York, and that was really beneficial for my life. It gave me a break, and I realized the apartment I was living in was not good for me. I had a neighbor that would slam doors and yell like I'm in, by jumping, like I can't live like that. So I was gonna rent a townhouse around here. They're like $1,200 a month rent. I said, shit, I can get a mortgage for that. So I started looking at houses, and I bought this house after I
When
left
did
the
you buy your
PTSD.
house?
So I left the PTSD program in March of 2016, and I closed on this house July 3rd of 2016.
Nice.
Yep.
Very
So a
nice.
couple months later, and then buying the house really helped me. I had established good relationships with the mental health clinic, and my therapist kept on saying like, maybe you should get a service dog. I already have a dog at home. He's a pet. He's a pain in my butt. I love him. I still got him to this day.
Is that Maxwell?
Yeah, that's Maxie. And so after, more than one person, I reached out to an organization and I said, hey, this is who I am. I've been told this. Let me know. It happened to be Rebuilding Warriors. And I spoke to then President Jeff Anderson. After talking for about 45 minutes on the phone, he said, I don't know when it will happen, but I'll get you a dog. This is on a Wednesday. My dad had open heart surgery that Monday. So I was in New Hampshire helping them out, my parents. I was going to be there for a month. Friday, Jeff calls me back. He said, when can you get a dog? It's mid-September. I said, I'm going to be here for at least a month. So they came out in October. I believe it was the 17th of 2016 that I received my first service animal from Rebuilding Warriors. And Rebuilding Warriors really became a community and a family for me. I still, go to their fundraisers and talk to other recipients and the leadership of the organization. But they gave me a dog, and it tremendously helped my life. Unfortunately, that dog got cancer before the age of seven and died. I was heartbroken when Bolt died. It was
That was Bolt.
I had to put him down. And so that was extremely hard, and they, called me, obviously through the whole, ordeal and afterwards, and they said, hey, Jeff said, what do you want? You want a puppy and train it yourself? You want us to train your dog? What do you want? And I said, I don't think I'm in the right, headspace right now to train a dog. No problem. They bought Shadow that same week that I put Bolt down. They trained him for 7 months, and then they came out. He would have been ready sooner, but no one wanted to come out to Buffalo before April.
Now,
So
where is Rebuilding Warriors located?
they don't really have a location. one, like, I think amazing thing about this nonprofit is it's all volunteer. The president, vice president, every board member, that's all volunteer. No one gets paid. All the money that they raise by, like, selling t-shirts or hats and stuff like that go to buying dogs for veterans. They use a few different trainers throughout the country. They try and, you know, keep East Coast dogs on the East Coast and West Coast just for price-wise. But I knew Valerie, she was the trainer, Valerie Phillips out in, she owns Sawtooth Kennels in California. And so she trained Shadow up for me and brought him out here. And I was actually talking to Jeff Anderson yesterday and just how far I've come as a person, just being able to integrate back into the community. And I know, you know, veterans say that all the time, politicians, everyone, how you're going to integrate back into the community. And you don't know that, how that's going to happen. And even if it will ever happen for you, I've just been fortunate to be linked up with the right people at the right time. So.
And, you know, I don't take this the wrong way, but you are a success story. Like, you're somebody that I look up to.
Not literally, just figuratively.
Yeah, no, yeah. I mean, everybody's taller than you, so I mean, let's just call a spade a spade.
The volunteer is, I'm taller than her, but she's also she's also 85, so I'm pretty sure she shrunk 3 inches.
Yeah. But no, I really do, and you know, I mean this, you know, wholeheartedly, and you know, with every ounce of love and respect to you, but I really do, like, you really are a success story, and I really do look up to you, and I look forward to you know, working with you, and you know seeing you every day and all that stuff. And but yeah, like, I think you have done amazing things, you know, and it's just, I think that you are proof for anyone out there listening, watching, whatever, you know, if, and this is something that I hold, that holds true in my life too. Like, if you can do it, if Miranda can do it, and if I can do it, anybody can do it. You know what I mean? And you have far more experience than I have as far as being deployed and, you know, combat and all that stuff. So, I can only imagine the amount of shit that you've seen or had to do. But yeah, anyone out there listening, you can do it. You know what I mean? And it's not like, you know, I think a lot of what I struggle with is people not wanting to do, veterans specifically, not wanting to do anything for themselves. Mm. Like, just, and you know, because we work in the agency that, you know, and the field that we work in. It seems, I could be wrong, but it seems that people just want things given to them on a silver platter.
I agree 100%. And I think part of the reason why I have been a success and I have been, you know, progressive in a positive way is the only one looking out for me is me. Like, I know I have friends and family, like, my family support, it has been tremendous. That's what got me through those 3 deployments. My sister and I emailed every day. So I would email her at night, and that's when she would wake up. She would, you know, so vice versa, you know, a couple of emails a day, you know, there's no texting.
Right.
So those, you know, that really helped me, them pushing me. And like you said, like, if you don't willing to do some of the work, why, you know what I mean? I'm not spoon feeding anyone anything. So,
right. And it's not easy. It's not going to be easy, but nothing, like I tell my kids, nothing in life worth having is ever going to be easy. You know what I mean? Like, your well-being, your mental health, your physical health and all that stuff. Like, it takes work, you know, to, you know, get to, you know, back to level, you know what I mean? Yeah. But yeah, like, I don't know, man. I just don't, I don't agree with the whole concept of, you know, like, I shouldn't say that. I agree. I think there's a level of, like, you know, the Vietnam era veterans, like the veterans that were drafted and all that stuff, like, I think that we should do whatever we have
Yeah,
to do to take
we
care
owe
of
them
them.
a lot just
Right.
because of the way they were treated. And it wasn't us treating them like that, but we know that that wasn't right.
And then our generation, OEF, OIF, like you gotta do stuff for yourself. You know what I mean? Like
Yeah.
nothing that we have in this life, nothing that I have in this life has ever been just handed to me. You know what I mean? There's nothing wrong with, I mean, I feel like that's how we're able to, not take things for granted to a certain extent, is because you have to work for these things. You have to work to get a house. You have to work to have a service dog, because having a service animal is not like having, like a regular old pet at home. Like I have Callie, my dog.
Who's a sweetheart?
Yeah, she's a nut job, but I love her. But yeah, like, having a service animal, you got to train them. And even though they've been trained and they're
Yeah.
given to you trained, but you have to maintain that training for as
Yes.
long as you have that dog. You know what I
Yeah.
mean?
I mean, you can get a fully trained dog and ruin it in less than a month. By the way, yeah. So, and that was one thing, like Rebuilding Warriors was great about, really connecting with the trainers. So I had Bolt for 2 years, and he stopped wanting to jump in the back of my Explorer. He wanted to get in the front seat and sit with me. Well, we had worked on him, so I had in a rental, so he was sitting in the front seat. So I would pick him up to put him back. He would cry like I was hurting him, and I'm stressing out because now I'm just caving, letting this dog sit in the front seat because I can't get him in the back. So I, swallow my pride. Push my ego aside and call his trainer. I tell him what's happening. He goes, "All right, well, what you do is you take the leash, you hold it back here, put it underneath their two front paws, and you walk him forward. He can't go back." It was that fucking easy. But it gets, I say all that to say, you gotta ask for help. Like something's not working, like fix it. And that doesn't go just with service animals or animals in general. That's life. If something's not working, stop doing it and, ask someone. Like,
I was just about to say, I'm glad you brought that up, because I think for, veterans in general, myself included, it's hard to ask for help. It's really hard to put yourself out there, especially when you don't want people to think that you're, whatever, broken, or you don't have all the answers to all the life's problems or issues or whatever. But yeah, I'm glad that you say that, because I feel like, and putting swallowing your pride, like you said, setting your ego aside and really taking time to look within yourself and realize that, yes, I do need help. I can't do this
yeah.
on my own. Like I really, really do need help. I'm glad you brought that up. I think of the, several different things that I hope to accomplish with this podcast, that is one, that's probably the number one thing, is helping veterans realize that all you have to do is ask for help. Some, there are people out there that will help you. You might get 100 no's,
Yep.
but eventually the odds will work in your favor, where there will be someone, that it's like you said, establishing relationships with folks and all that stuff. Same, when I bought my house, I never in a million years would have bought my house if I hadn't had a connection with, a lady that literally helped me do everything as far as
Yeah.
buying my house and got me in contact with the realtor and all that stuff, but yeah, I think just, building relationships and opening yourself up and letting those relationships bloom, I think that's a big thing. A lot of what I struggle with too is shutting down and kind of being a hermit and staying in my house and not going any, going anywhere. Yeah, just, building those relationships and having those people in your corner, that family support and all that jazz is outstanding. And I'm super, super happy for you, and I am, look
You're
forward
part
to
of my,
seeing.
you know what I mean? You're my friend, but my brother from another mother, your support. I know if I called you at 2 and you didn't pick up and I called you 5 more times, you would be over at my house being, what the hell happened? You know, like, I know you got my back like that.
Yeah.
And so realizing that people do have that and vice versa, I'm, you know, black trash bags and pitchforks. Let's go.
Right. Yeah. I think our bond that we have for not knowing each other very long, it's easy. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
There is nothing about our relationship that is hard.
Yeah.
It just flows. It just works, you know?
And one thing I know is why we get along so well is we're both respectful. If you do something that you think is rude, hey, I'm sorry I did that. Like, and I'm like, we good. It's cool. And I'm the same way to you. Like, hey, I didn't mean it. Like, you know, if you're upset, blah, blah, because we are so respectful to each other that it's easy to get along.
Yeah. Yeah. I worry about, for me, like my personality, I'm a people pleaser. Like I don't like making people mad or, you know, having people upset with me and, or anything like that. So, I mean, I probably apologize more than I should. You know, certain things, you know what I mean? But yeah, like I would never do anything malicious or out of, you know, malice, you know, or spite towards anyone, even people that I don't really like. I mean, I may not, you know, talk to you all the time or whatever, but like, ultimately I think it's a human thing, you know, like I want to see people succeed and, you know, I don't think, you know, being respectful is wrong. Even if I don't necessarily agree with, you know, certain, you know, people's, you know, whatever, but yeah. So, how's things going now for you? As far as, do you want to talk just a little bit, like, you know, you're working and
yeah, so all that stuff. After I got shadow, you know, my sister was like, you need to get a job. And it wasn't financially, I can pay my bills fine with the income that I have. Mm-hmm. But it was to get myself out there. So I started working with a vocational counselor at the VA, did a resume, all that stuff, started applying for jobs. Nothing, crickets. No one wanted to hire me because I hadn't worked for quite a few years. So I reached, fast forward a year previous to that, I had met a female veteran on a fishing trip up in Lake Ontario, and she had told me about this woman's Facebook group and to join it. So I did. And when I was having, you know, difficulties trying to find work, I reached out to one of the founding member of the group, Lynn Magistrati, and asked her if she knew, you know, this is my situation. I have a service animal. This is what I'm good at. This is what I can do. This is what I can't do. She sent me 2 job postings back. One was for National Fuel. The other one was for Western York Heroes. And it was a dual job of outreach and casework. When I read the job description, I said, I would love to do that. And I'm talking to her on the phone and I can hear Chris Krieger, the president, in the background, just get down here. So I got my shit down there. I went down there. We were sitting for about 20 minutes and Chris goes, how much do you want to make an hour? I said, not a lot. Lynn goes, good, because we're a nonprofit. and they really took a chance on me. Chris and I really didn't know each other from the limited interactions we had in the community. They weren't the most positive. I didn't really know him. He didn't know me. We didn't think the highest of each other. And they took a chance on me and they have really become family, just like you and everyone else at Western York Heroes. And one thing I love is like we do the casework. So we're, you know, helping veterans and their families with financial struggles and being able to, you know, help other veterans, you know, and it's not a handout, it's a hand up. Like we're helping you move your location, start over, do something different, get caught back up after a tragedy or a significant loss in your life. And then the outreach events. So we have grown as an organization over the last year. But before I was, going to events by myself, I would go to a location I had never been before, people I'd never been, but I could talk about Western New York Heroes and all the great things that we did and do. And it was, that's easy. It's easy mission to get behind with them. And it's great going out into the community and meeting so many different people at schools, churches, events, you know, fundraising, all different, you know, volunteering for the Buffalo Marathon, just getting myself out there. And, you know, growth happens when we're uncomfortable. And I've grown so much in the last year and a half from working at Western New York Heroes. And Lynn and Chris have been more than accommodating. They're amazing. And they're great humans, you know, helping, you know, Chris has been doing this for a long time. And, you know, they were, you know, a three-man team at one point. So it's pretty amazing and pretty remarkable how much they've grown and how much good they've done for this community. And, you know, I'm sure you feel the same way, but it's easy to get behind it. And it's a good, like, what do? I work for a nonprofit. Oh, yeah, which one? Western New York Heroes. We're fucking killing it. We're helping people and saving lives, man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. I mean, obviously, you know, same thing. I would piggyback off what you said as far as them taking a chance on me. They took a chance on me as well, you know, coming to work there, leaving the VA, not really knowing what I wanted to do, you know, because I felt like the VA was something I was going to do for the rest of my life until I retired.
Yeah.
And then that kind of, I don't want to say soured, but I just couldn't do it anymore. You know what I mean?
You had to pivot. You had to change.
Right. I had to. Yep. Good choice of words. I definitely had to pivot into essentially doing the same thing that I was doing at the VA, just a little bit different, but with a different organization now. But yeah, I'm super happy with and thankful and appreciative of everything that Western New York Heroes, Lynn and Chris have done for me, for you, for any of the other veterans that, you know, we've helped in the past or will help in the future. Again, there are people out there that want to help and that want to, you know, see you succeed and, you know, see you do good things in this world. Cause like, you know, my brother Shane had said in the podcast that we do, like your mission is not over, you know, the world needs you in it. So don't give up. There are, you know, people out there that you can take inspiration from and, you know, continue to, you know, fight the good fight. But, yeah. All right. Well, we're coming up on about an hour and 10 minutes. So is there anything else you want to say before we wrap it up or how do you feel? How are you feeling right now?
I feel good. And it's really interesting because, you know, we've talked about, you know, from childhood all the way up, and maybe 6-7 years ago, Miranda would have been like, oh, I feel like, you know, I'll word vomit war stories, all that stuff. I have no control or it just comes out because it's was and is such a big part of my life, you know, who I am.
Right.
But now I feel good. I feel motivated. I'm glad that we did this.
Good.
And I would say, you know, what we talked about is, you know, going out and helping yourself. I felt sorry for myself for a while. I mean, my peers were majors, lieutenant colonel. Now they're full board colonels. And, you know, I like, you're a piece of shit. You didn't make it. You didn't get that far. Well, that wasn't my mission, you know.
Right.
I didn't pick the mission, but that's not mine now. Right. And so you have to get over yourself before you can start helping yourself.
Yep. Yeah. And I think, you know, and I'll make this short, but I, you know, you got to find something that gives you that drive again. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Something positive, obviously. Nothing, you know, negative or anything like that. But you know, being a productive member of society is, I think, key for any veteran or any service member that's transitioning into the civilian sector, or whatever you want to call it. So yeah, I mean, just again, thank you again for taking the time to sit down with me and let me ask you some questions. And obviously, like, I hope that, you know, there was, you know, you didn't get upset or anything like that. But I think this is very good, you know, for me too. Again, this is therapy. And I feel like, you know, us just talking
Yes.
works wonders. You know what I mean? But yeah, thanks for taking the time out of your busy day to sit down with me, and
Busy.
I definitely appreciate you. And again, I couldn't do this without you. So,
Well, thanks for having me. When you said you were doing it, and I was like, "Can I be on it?" You're like, "Yeah." I was gonna ask you, and I was like, "Oh, thank God." But yeah, it's easy, you know, because I saw, you know, what you're just talking about, getting excited about something. I saw that in you when you want to start this. So hell yeah, I'll get behind you.
Oh, good. I'm glad people. I hope that I'm representing this well. I feel like I'm passionate about it, but I'm trying not to be too passionate because I feel like that could kind of be a negative too. You know what I mean? Like you're up in people's faces and stuff like that, and that's not who I am as a person. So I just want it to happen naturally. Just when it, if it if you want to be on, anybody out there listening or watching, if I haven't already reached out to you or anything like that, it's nothing disrespectful towards you or anything like that. I don't want to force the subject with folks, but if you're listening or if you're watching and you want to be on the podcast, just shoot me an email, or if we're friends on Facebook, direct message me on Facebook and we'll get it figured out. But anyway, all right. Well, I hope everyone out there in the listening audience has a blessed day. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being here. And we'll catch you on the flip side. We're out.